Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
It's Tuesday, July 10th, 2018, and this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out what Valley dairy farmers have to say about being in the crosshairs of a global trade war. And we'll learn about the new fight over the future of Mono Lake in the Eastern Sierra. We begin, though, on the issue of homelessness. Last week, we reported how Mayor Lee Brand hopes his new initiative finds common ground between homeless advocates and organizations. At the same time, a group of neighbors in northwest Fresno released a video urging people not to give out money to people on the street. They say not everyone with signs are homeless, and they claim giving out money hurts more than it helps. Valley Public Radio's Laura Tsutsui reports the group has support from city officials, but they're facing pushback from some homeless advocates.
Most of the people that we deal out here is like homeless. I mean, they don't do anything bad, but a lot of people don't like them around.
Long Zhang says that dealing with homeless people is a daily occurrence. He's a security guard in northwest Fresno at Shaw and Valentine. He patrols the parking lot in front of the Broadway Fair movie theater. In the year that he's watched this particular area, he says that there seems to be less homeless people around.
Yeah, there were people camping around stuff, so we had to like tell them to kind of move out of the property. I mean, honestly, I'm kind of glad that it was rough before, but I'm kind of glad they got kind of cooled down a little bit. I can't really say it, but I'm pretty sure it's pretty bad at the place too.
Zhang couldn't say whether the change is because of the city's no camping ban, which was created last year. But where he feels like the homeless population has gone down, one group of residents has spoken up with concerns that homelessness along this area of Shaw is growing.
There's some that are actually, I think there's like 5% of them that are legit, need help. That's the one thing I learned when I did this documentary. There is a major difference between panhandlers and homeless. Most panhandlers are not homeless.
That's Jim Jacobs, an assistant news director for ABC 30 and a resident of the area. He started the Facebook group Save Shaw Avenue back in February after noticing that a few nearby businesses were shutting down.
So really, it started with Tahoe Joe's shutting down, and then Toys R Us is shutting down, and I started out right here going, okay, and then I noticed like some homeless people on the corner. I'm like, okay, this is just not good. And I thought, okay, gosh, if our businesses start disappearing here, then what's gonna come in here? Nothing.
Jacob says the idea is to ultimately save Shaw Avenue from blight and get people excited about bringing business to the area. The group has become a virtual neighborhood watch that focuses on the western region of Shaw from Marks to Highway 99. A quick scroll through the group shows a number of posts about graffiti and encounters with homeless people. Jacob says he wants to make the page a place for conversation, but also for education.
And we're trying to encourage people to give to charity rather than just hand out stuff out the windows, because that's just, it's killing these folks out here and it's killing our businesses.
Last week, the group published an 8-minute long video Jacobs produced entitled Save Shaw Avenue. It emphasizes his message that there's a difference between panhandlers and those who are genuinely homeless. Voices from the Fresno Rescue Mission and the mayor's office claim that giving out money to people hurts more than it helps. They say the handouts enable people to get by while living on the street without seeking further assistance. That area of Shaw Avenue straddles Districts 1 and 2, and both Council Member Steve Brandow and Council President Esmeralda Soria have expressed support for the group's enthusiasm. Brandow, who represents the north side of Shaw, has even attended the group's recent neighborhood cleanup.
They've got some goals for Shaw. They're tired of the blight. They know there is a homeless element, and you know they're very concerned about not letting Shaw degrade further than it has. So I think it's fantastic.
Brandow says that hearing from businesses about homelessness motivated him to propose the camping ban last year. He adds that homelessness is probably not the only reason for businesses leaving the area.
But there's other problems that are impacting Shaw, and some of them are real simple, and some of them are outside of our control. Like, for instance, the struggle of retail in the internet age, right? There's other big retail outlets and huge shopping centers that are attracting people with other activities, theaters, and all kinds of different stuff that also pull people away from Shaw and other streets as well.
Council President Esmeralda Soria represents Southwest Fresno, including the south side of Shaw Avenue. She says that this is actually the first time she's heard complaints about homelessness from that part of her district. Throughout the city, though, Soria says she wants to see a comprehensive approach to the issue.
The city can't solve homelessness on our own, which is, you know, the reasons that we've entered into partnerships with the Fresno Rescue Mission, the Housing Authority, Poverello. But we really need to just continue working together, one, to improve the quality of life of the homeless population and of the residents, obviously, that live in those surrounding neighborhoods, but that we also tackle some of the issues that come with, you know, this population.
That seems to be the overall goal of Save Shaw Avenue: find ways to reduce homelessness and improve the area to appeal to businesses. But some homeless advocates have pushed back, saying that to dissuade people from handing out money is cruel in itself.
If being cruel to the homeless, which has been the policy of the city of Fresno for decades now, if that was successful, homelessness would have been over a long time ago.
Mike Rhodes is a longtime Fresno activist and author of a book about homelessness in Fresno called Dispatches from the War Zone. He says that the city and organizations could reduce homelessness just by providing a safe and legal place where people could stay and manage their possessions.
I'm not saying that if you give a homeless person a dollar, that's going to solve homelessness. But it's just a basic human thing to want to help people out, get them through a difficult time.
Jim Jacobs says that, for the most part, the video and group have received positive feedback. But he knows that there are those, like Mike Rhodes, who disagree with him.
Oh, it's a sticky wicket. I get it. I mean, I've been yelled at. We've been told that we're hunting homeless, and we're cold-hearted, we're hypocritical. And I try and let them know, no, I'm not out there hunting homeless. I'm out there trying to help them and educate people on how to help them.
For now, one has to wonder if that will be enough to save Shaw Avenue. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. It's summer, a time when some people go to beaches or national parks or take in a movie with air conditioning to cool down. Others will go to Central California's Indian casinos, where gaming tribes are working different angles, seeking your betting dollar. The Table Mountain Rancheria has big plans for a new casino, hotel, and resort near Millerton Lake, about 20 minutes north of Fresno. Other proposals are pending, too. So, when will there be too much gaming in the valley? Or is the area approaching oversaturation already? Reporter Mark Benjamin takes a look at where Central California gaming could be headed.
Desiree Uzel has been a loyal Table Mountain Casino customer since it opened 31 years ago.
It's a fun place to go. It's close. It's clean. You tend to win, and they do have bingo. There's one machine that we do particularly enjoy, and it's called Hearts Lock. And you have to lock the hearts when you get into a bonus round, and every time you lock a heart, the bonus amount goes up.
And Uzel is excited about Table Mountain's plans. It's been years in the works for one of the oldest gaming tribes in the state. There will be a larger casino, events facility, and bingo hall, and a 151-room hotel and resort. The old casino will be renovated as tribal government offices. Uzel already enjoys the food and is encouraged to know the system that filters cigarette smoke will get upgraded. It's an issue the tribe is anxious to address. Table Mountain tribal lawyer Daniel Casas says the tribe wants to improve the experience for customers.
We wanted more floor space to have people to be able to move around without having to bump into machines or other individuals, so it's better for the patrons. Secondly, we wanted to have a higher ceiling for better ventilation.
The new project is estimated to cost up to $300 million. Casas says it will be self-financed. Traffic is expected to double, and the tribe is paying a percentage of more than a dozen road and intersection improvements, some as distant as the northern fringes of Fresno and Clovis. These projects will cost $10 million or more. Casas says the tribe has already paid millions widening Bryant Road, and road design for other projects is in the early stages. Gaming experts say Table Mountain is poised to capitalize on the local market. Table Mountain isn't the only game in town. Near Lemoore, Tachi Palace is 3 months from opening a family entertainment complex with a theater, arcade, bowling alley, and billiards hall. But it's the newer casino projects that generally draw patrons. Kenneth Hansen, a Fresno State political science and American Indian Studies professor, is author of The New Politics of Indian Gaming. He says proximity to Fresno gives Table Mountain a leg up.
For a lot of people, it might be convenient. In the case of building a hotel at Table Mountain, people might stay there out of convenience as opposed to coming in from out of town.
Out-of-town visitors are usually on highways. Highway 41 passes by Chukchansi Gold Resort and Casino for motorists headed toward Yosemite, and Hansen says it will likely remain a popular stop for tourists. And new also is in the plans near Porterville, where the Tule River Indian Tribe wants to relocate Eagle Mountain Casino from its out-of-the-way foothill location to the Porterville Airport. Tribe officials are hoping for a federal government decision this summer that will allow them to push ahead with their $180 million casino and hotel expansion. Still, there are other tribes trying to get in the game. Aubrey's Big Sandy Rancheria has an expansion plan. The Tone Tribe has a proposal near Bakersfield, and so does North Fork Rancheria. But with all these proposals, when will the Valley have too much gaming? The Valley already has a slot machine for every 380 residents. In Southern California, the ratio is about one for every 540 residents. Then there are demographic trends to consider. Again, Fresno State professor Kenneth Hansen.
The demographic that gambles in California at these places is starting to decline. You know, they tend to be older Americans. So as the folks that gamble pass on, and if they're not replaced by other folks, then there's no guarantee that there's going to be much of a market. So, you know, the market share could become more competitive as the market contracts.
This means the strategy for gaming is changing, both in the types of games offered and the types of attractions used to draw crowds. Retired Whittier College professor and gaming lawyer I. Nelson Rose says millennials have driven Nevada casinos to put USB ports at slot machines and change their strategies about both gaming and attracting crowds.
There is this trend, particularly with millennials, to spend a lot of time in casino hotels, but not to gamble, to spend time on shopping, dining, and going to the entertainment facilities. This has hit Nevada already, that the number of slot machines in Nevada have actually gone down.
Rose has studied the Fresno market, and he thinks local casinos may be ahead of the curve. For now, he says, oversaturation isn't a problem.
They need to be entertainment centers and places where people can just gather for an evening. I don't think they're going to have trouble making money.
But for Table Mountain, reinvention is not in the cards. Tribal lawyer Casas says the tribe wants to continue to keep the crowd that comes now. Along those lines, he says, the casino also will continue its rule of not serving alcoholic beverages even after the expansion.
Our goal is really to service our current client base. I think there may be more people coming just to look, but I think it's convenient for the local community. We don't plan to make it too extravagant so we scare our customers away. We want to make sure our customers feel comfortable and welcome.
And that meets with the approval of Desiree Uzel.
The hotel would be a great idea. I think it'd be great for the community. I think it'd be great for jobs. And a newer casino would be nice, just for the smoke aspect of it. Because the old casino right now, it can get pretty smoky in there.
Construction for the new Table Mountain Casino will begin early next year. This is Mark Benjamin.
And Mark joins us now in studio to continue the conversation and give us some updates on what's happening with some of those other tribes you mentioned in the piece. Mark, the tribe in the Tule River Tribe near Porterville, they have a casino that's very out of the way right now. You mentioned that they're planning to move to the Porterville Airport. I thought that was almost a done deal a while ago. What's happening there?
That still needs to be placed into federal trust, and the federal government is working on that. The tribe has been to Washington, D.C. to lobby the federal government for placing that land into federal trust, and then they will also still have to renegotiate a gaming compact with the state to move ahead with that. That could take months, years. I mean, it is a long-term process.
Now, the issue with off-reservation gaming is controversial throughout California. Is there a chance that they could face a threat from Cheryl Smith and her group, Stand Up California, like the North Fork Casino did?
It is possible. However, in speaking with Cheryl Schmidt, she says it looks like there's a great deal of community support for that project, and that may not be in the cards, so to speak, for that one.
She led the fight, Prop 48, a couple of years ago.
Correct.
Against the North Fork tribe's effort to build a casino on Highway 99 in Madera. Mm-hmm. What is the latest with that story as that's been going on?
There are right now two pending lawsuits. One lawsuit was won by the North Fork tribe in the spring. It could be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. That one suggests that the Department of Interior acted within its authority by allowing the casino to take the land into trust for the tribe. Cheryl Schmidt tells me that they are considering an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's not clear whether they will move ahead. Legal scholars I've spoken to indicate that there are low odds that that will get heard before the U.S. Supreme Court. Yet, that's a possibility.
Is that good for the tribe or bad for the tribe?
If it gets heard in the U.S. Supreme Court, probably pretty bad, because it'll take much longer time to get that to wind through the process. A second case in the California Supreme Court is yet to be decided. It's a state case that examines Governor Brown's ability to approve off-reservation gaming, and so that one is yet to be decided. It's not clear how that one will go.
And didn't California voters reject that proposition?
It depends how you use that wording. They actually approved the proposition, which rejected the compact.
Yes, thank you.
By a 61% to 39% margin.
But it's still moving forward regardless.
It is, because while it suggested the compact wasn't valid, the tribe had the right to go back to the federal government, petition the federal government again, and have it heard by an arbitrator. And then the arbitrator okayed it, and the governor didn't have to sign off on it, and didn't, but it's still valid.
Now, before we go, Highway 99 is not the only, or the only casino on Highway 99 proposed is not in Madera. In Kern County, you mentioned the Tejon tribe. Where are they in this process? This is not just a one-year kind of thing, I guess.
They are well behind North Fork and will probably await a similar fate in the courts should they be moving forward at any point in the future.
How long does it take one of these tribes to get a casino approved off-reservation right now?
Right now, North Fork is probably close to its 15th year. And speaking to I. Nelson Rose, he consults with these groups that want to buy property and then turn it into Indian gaming casinos. He tells them, you're going to need 20 years and $20 million to do this. So you're probably just better off building the hotel and letting it make profit that way.
Very interesting. Mark Benjamin joining us to talk more about tribal gaming. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. There's new research out from scientists at UC Merced that could shed light on autoimmune diseases. The study in the Journal of Immunology looks at so-called misbehaving killer immune cells. Here to tell us more is quantitative systems biology graduate student Kristen Valentine and UC Merced professor Katrina Hoyer. Katrina, I want to start with you. This builds on research that took place in 1998 when scientists first noticed these misbehaving immune cells. Walk me through the genesis of how that led to your new research.
Well, CD8 T cells are cells that we call our killer cells. Their normal job is to go out and find cells that are infected with a virus or that have become cancerous and target those cells for destruction. But the immune system kind of has their own little space in the body. The cells move around a lot, but they also move to different parts of the body specifically. So each type of immune cell kind of has their own little home within, say, the lymph node or the spleen. And so what was found is that these killer cells are moving into a different location than they normally would be found. And so this is what was identified back in the 90s that we and several other researchers have started following up on more recently.
In reading this, some of the highlights of this, it sounds like this was kind of discovered and then quickly overlooked for two decades. How did that happen?
That's a good question. I mean, people get excited about different areas of research, and part of it is the tools that are available to us. The tools have become much better in immunology and have allowed us to go back and look more closely at these cells and what they're doing. The imaging tools have allowed us to look at where they are localized within different parts of the body. So I think some of it was not a lack of interest, but maybe just waiting for the tools to develop.
So in more recent years, there's been renewed interest in these cells as they relate to cancer and chronic viral infections, but you brought it back to the autoimmune diseases, and I want to bring in a graduate student, Kristen Valentine, here, who is also part of this new study in the Journal of Immunology. Kristen, when you looked at these killer cells that are quote-unquote misbehaving, how does this change the way we think about autoimmune diseases? What's new here as it relates to our understanding of autoimmune diseases?
So a lot of what we have established thus far has been in a population that traditionally help other cells do their job better, and these are called CD4 T cells. We understand these a lot more in general. So the CD8 killer cells are new and novel in that we haven't ever studied them before. So now looking at them in this misbehaving capacity, we are seeing that they actually, instead of killing cells, promote a helper-like function to cause other cells to do their job better, but in this case, it's causing autoimmune disease. So in this way, we've added a new layer to our understanding of the cells involved in autoimmune disease.
How exciting was it to do this work and advance something that could potentially help so many people?
It's been very exciting. For the most part, my research, this started as a side project. And when it started to take off, we noticed really exciting features and phenotypes. So I've been able to take it pretty far, and it's kind of taken over my whole thesis project for my PhD. So it's been exciting, and the fact that it's causing a lot of interest has added to this realm, I suppose.
I want to bring back UC Merced Professor Katrina Hoyer now into the conversation. Katrina, so with this study that's now been published in a prestigious journal, where does the research go from here, and how could this potentially help people down the road with autoimmune diseases?
That's a great question. So Kristen is continuing this project, trying to better understand kind of the nuances of the function. So as she said, we have cells called CD4 helper cells that already have this known function of helping other cells do their job. And so we're trying to understand the similarities with these new CD8 kind of helper-like cells, trying to understand, instead of killing, how are they helping, and are they helping in the same way, or do they have kind of slightly different functions that we can try to understand? So she's continuing that work, and then I have a second graduate student who is looking at a lot of the signaling that's happening in these cells and trying to understand how they're communicating and how that influences their function.
Are we going to be seeing more research, not necessarily just on this topic, but more research like this coming out of UC Merced in years to come?
Oh, I certainly hope so. So my lab's primary focus is this autoimmune disease component, but since moving to UC Merced, I've also started to focus on valley fever. So half of my lab is also working on valley fever and trying to understand the immune responses and the immune dysfunction that happens during that disease.
So Katrina, with the interest right now in the field of cancer research on immunotherapy and all of these big advances we've seen recently here treating some very serious forms of cancer, how are these two areas coming together?
So these CD8 killer cells, I mean, their normal function is to go out and target cancer cells and virally infected cells. And the fact that they can move into other locations that we weren't previously aware they could move to may allow us to kind of harness that potential as a way to target these cells to where the cancer is located, particularly in things like B-cell lymphomas, because they can move into the region where the B-cell lymphomas are found. And the fact that these CD8 cells have a lot more flexibility than we thought previously may allow us to manipulate that in order to push them to become more helper-like or more killer-like in their function.
So I just want to take a step back here. You're saying that, if I understand it correctly, this function that you've observed here in this research or these cells moving to other places, which in one case can cause disease, might in the future be actually used to treat disease.
Yes. And in fact, that's what they're finding looking at these cells in viral infection, is that perhaps these cells are helping to target HIV-infected cells in a location where we didn't think there was a way to kill the infected cells.
It's fascinating new research out of UC Merced. We've been talking with UC Merced Professor Katrina Hoyer and Quantitative Systems Biology graduate student Kristen Valentine, authors of a new study in the Journal of Immunology that looks at so-called misbehaving killer immune cells and shedding new light on autoimmune diseases and, as we just heard, there, cancer research and other potential opportunities there. The world of science and medical research is fascinating, and so happy to have both of you on our program today from Merced.
Thank you so much for having us. It's always a pleasure to talk about our science.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Mono Lake is one of the jewels of the Eastern Sierra. Its saline waters have created a unique ecosystem, providing habitat for everything from brine shrimp to migratory birds. But for years, Mono Lake has had a problem: water diversions made by the city of Los Angeles that began in the last century. In the mid-1990s, a deal was reached that both the L.A. Department of Water and Power and conservationists hope would save the lake and increase water levels. And for a time, water levels did increase. But now that plan is in jeopardy. Here to tell us more is L.A. Times journalist Louis Sahagan, who joins us on the phone. Louis, welcome.
Thank you.
This is not just a problem for the ecosystem, though. It's also a problem for public health. These dust storms are a big concern. What is the problem there?
The problem is that on windy days, particulates of 10 microns or less are kicked up in these vast clouds. These particulates lodge in the lungs and they cause respiratory injuries. And so they're regulated by federal law. But dust storms at Mono Lake exceeded federal standards 33 times in 2016. And today, Mono Lake is the largest source of toxic particulates in the world. That title was formerly held by Owens Lake, which was drained by the Los Angeles Aqueduct System in the 1920s. LA had to spend over $1 billion to reduce that dust by 95% down at Owens Lake. So now that awful title is held by Mono Lake, about 150 miles to the north.
So when LA began diverting water at Mono Lake, the level began to drop. That caused alarm and brought about this issue of dust storms. But something then happened in the 1990s that changed the trajectory of things. Tell me about this agreement that was reached back then, and what did it call for?
Well, essentially, there was an agreement. Actually, it was a landmark State Water Resources Control Board decision in 1994 that capped Los Angeles's diversions of water from tributary streams of Mono Lake. And that was needed in order to deal with the dust, but also to safeguard the environment, not just of the lake, but also the vitality of the five streams that pour into the lake. So that agreement set a level. It said essentially that the level of Mono Lake had to be raised to 6,392 feet above sea level, and that the way to do that was by significantly reducing diversions from streams controlled by the city of Los Angeles. Originally, when that decision was made, it was believed that the water level would rise to that target level within 20 years. That has not happened. And today, it's about 10 feet below the target, And some people think it won't reach that target level for another 4 decades.
And of course, California has been dealing with a number of issues here. Number one, a severe drought. The drought that began in 2012 was one issue. But then the overall issue of climate change and changing precipitation patterns, is that the big problem here?
The big problem now is that weather is not behaving the way it did when that 1994 decision was reached. Back then, there were certain assumptions about the way weather behaved, about the amount of snow the Sierras would get, about the amount of rain, about evaporation rates. But what's happened is since then, it's actually within the last 10 years, the area has experienced extraordinary shifts in extremes of weather, from 5 years of severe drought to last year, for example, a historic deluge of snowmelt. But overall, the lake isn't, meanwhile, getting the water level to rise enough to meet the 1994 agreement. So the Great Basin Air Quality Management District, which is in charge of clean air in that area, it is saying now we have to recalibrate our measurements, our computer models, the weather in that area. Otherwise, we're not going to really understand what's happening, and we will wind up being in violation of that 1994 agreement. And in the meantime, while we're recalibrating to include new ideas and models that include, you know, extremes of weather due to climate change, the cheapest, easiest way to deal with the dust problem that we have is for LA to reduce its exports of water even more than it already has to meet that 1994 agreement. Los Angeles is saying, wait a minute, we've already reduced dramatically in 1994 to meet the requirements of the decision. The problem today is not us. The problem today is climate change. So we are not going to reduce our water exports, but we're not arguing with the idea that whether you call it drought or whether you call it climate change, all of the, you know, those things do have to be taken into account in terms of controlling the water and safeguarding the environment and knocking down the dust. But we're not reducing water. We don't feel that's necessary. Great Basin is saying, well, wait a minute there. You folks set the stage for the problem we're experiencing when you began diverting water from this area, Mona Basin, in 1941. So you are responsible. And again, the cheapest, most elegant way of dealing with this is for you to reduce your water even more, and we need to talk about that. So there's a showdown.
A showdown is apparently looming. What does the Department of Water and Power say? You have a quote in your article that's in the LA Times with their senior assistant general manager, Rick Harrisick, saying that LA's diversions have a, quote, very limited influence on the lake's elevation. This sounds like this is truly a showdown that's looming here.
Yes. So he's saying LA's diversions have a limited effect on the lake level. But Great Basin is saying there's a combination in play here, a combination of your ongoing diversions and these quick shifts in extreme weather conditions that are making it increasingly difficult to meet the requirements of the State Water Board decision. So it's those two dynamics that are causing the problem, not just one or the other.
When it comes to those changing climate trends, changing precipitation patterns, we've seen dramatic shifts just within the last few years with the lake elevation, have we not?
We have. Last year, a historic amount of snowmelt cascading off the eastern slopes of the Sierra Nevada put 5 feet of water into the lake. That is an incredible sock of water, right? but it wasn't enough. It's still 10 feet below the 1994 requirement. So, and that is because despite that historic input of water, it was preceded by 5 years of severe drought. So even that colossal input of water wasn't enough to get close to the required level.
You mentioned that the cheapest and easiest way to deal with this dust problem is raising the level of the lake. What are the other options there? With the $1 billion the city of Los Angeles has spent thus far on dust mitigation at Owens Lake, a little further south on Highway 395, is a similar scenario potentially available there?
There is already a building concern in the Mono Lake area among conservationists and also Paiute tribal leaders in the area who do not want to see Mono Lake's shoreline or edges covered with crushed rock, planted with vegetation, etched with furrowing, and the kinds of things that have been used to knock down the dust at Owens. People don't want to see that here. If you go to Owens Lake today, as I say, the dust problem, which was the worst in the world for decades, has now been reduced by 95%. But if you drive by Owens Lake, honestly, it looks, it's starting to look industrial. Not starting, it does. Covered with crushed rock, shallow flooding, these furrows. And people don't want to see that at Mono. And I'm not saying they're right or wrong. I'm just saying their argument is, wait a minute, LA, we think that maybe you could do more to conserve water in Los Angeles, in that metropolis down there. And then you could reduce your exports of water up here and make up for it by conserving a little more down there in LA. And then we don't have to cover Mono with the crushed rock.
So where does this story go from here? You mentioned this is headed for a showdown. More job security for California water attorneys?
Yes. Well, yeah, according to Great Basin Air Quality Management District, they are saying, you know, there are health risks involved here, serious ones, potentially serious ones. And while they are not allowed by law to interfere with the aqueduct system, they can sue Los Angeles in order to clean up the air. And if they sue Los Angeles, they are entitled to lawyers' fees paid by Los Angeles. So the fact that they're even warning such a thing means, I think, it says a lot about how serious they are about this.
Again, we've been talking about the new fight that is brewing over Mono Lake, continued diversions from the city of Los Angeles converging with the threat of climate change, mean the lake's level is not where officials want it to be under a 1994 agreement, and that is heading for a showdown. You can read about it in the Los Angeles Times. Our guest today, journalist Lewis Hagen, joining us on the phone. Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Buried in California's $201 billion budget is important news for a disease affecting many in Central California. For several years now, we've been reporting on the fungal disease Valley Fever, which is endemic to arid regions of the U.S. Southwest. The California legislature this year has seen an uptick in bills related to the disease, and some even bigger news came out in the new state budget that took effect last week. We have Carrie Klein in the studio to talk with us about it. Carrie, welcome.
Good morning, Joe.
Carrie, the big news about Valley Fever involves a lot of money. What happened in this most recent budget for this disease?
That's right. As you said, Governor Brown just signed and brought into effect his final budget of his time as governor. And in that $201 billion is $8 million for Valley Fever research, as well as awareness and outreach. It's the most funding that the state has allocated for Valley Fever since 1998, when there was legislation passed related to vaccine research.
So where is this money going? Do we know that yet?
We do know, at least loosely. So the $8 million is split among three main entities. And so for disease research, $3 million will be going to the University of California system, and $3 million will be going to Kern Medical in Bakersfield, which recently established a Valley Fever Institute. Now, it's not exactly sure how those pots of money will be spent specifically once in those institutions, but at least on the Kern Medical side, one main line of inquiry that they've been talking about for a long time is wanting to do immunogenic studies. So examining why people exposed to the same spores can react so differently to them and why certain groups appear to be more vulnerable than others. So that's likely something that they'll be focusing on. And then there's the final $2 million of this $8 million, and that's going toward awareness and outreach by the California Department of Public Health. And $2 million is a pretty big amount for that. I mean, if we recall last year, the Kern County Health Department, they brought in an awareness campaign involving PSAs featuring Sheriff Youngblood. And that campaign was many years in the making. The department had wanted to do something like that for a long time, and that cost $15,000. So now the state has $2 million. So it's pretty huge.
So it seems like every few years, Valley Fever advocates get excited. A new bill seems to appear in Sacramento. But sometimes those dreams are crushed at the signing deadline.
Sadly,
that
yes.
was what we saw last year with Governor Brown vetoing a major bill. How does this compare to what was on his desk last year outside of the budget process?
Yeah, so that's a good point. This seems actually pretty similar to that bill from last year. So that bill was that you're talking about. It was introduced by Assemblymember Rudy Salas last year. He's someone who's been really forging a lot of this Valley Fever legislation these last couple years. And that bill aimed to get $2 million to the state to the California Department of Public Health for an awareness and outreach campaign. It passed the state Senate and Assembly with flying colors, with bipartisan support last year, and then Governor Brown vetoed it, supposedly on the pretense of not having the funding for it. But now he just approved the funding. That's exactly what's happening is $2 million is going to the Department of Public Health. So the nuts and bolts might not be exactly the same between what that would have allocated and what's happening now with this year, but now the funding is there and it's ready to be put toward preventing this disease.
This has been a big year for Valley Fever legislation. What else is happening on the disease front in Sacramento?
Yeah, this year really started with a bang when it comes to Valley Fever legislation. So there were six bills introduced earlier this year, both by Rudy Salas and Assemblymember Vince Fong, both in the South Valley. They were hailed as the most robust Valley Fever legislation ever introduced in California, at least hailed that way by some. And now those six bills have been funneled down into three, and one would streamline reporting, one would speed up disease diagnosis, and one would bolster doctor training. And all three have passed the state assembly and have moved on to the state Senate. They've seen overwhelming support with hardly any no votes. But it still has yet to be seen exactly what will happen to them. They're still making their way through the legislature. And then in addition to that, there's been some federal legislation. So U.S. Senator Kamala Harris introduced a national Valley Fever bill a few weeks ago. It would improve and standardize disease reporting, and it would direct the CDC and USDA to work together to fuel new research. And of course, that's pretty new, so we have yet to see really what's going to happen with that. But those other three bills in the state legislature are still making their way through.
And even in a very polarized Washington political climate, Valley Fever has been something that's gained bipartisan support. Kamala Harris supporting that issue, as well as Bakersfield's Kevin McCarthy, poised to perhaps become the next Speaker of the House. So we'll see where that goes.
Yes, indeed.
We'll also see where the disease itself goes. I understand this has been a challenging year for people dealing with Valley Fever thus far. Where are we with the numbers thus far in 2018 on Valley Fever rates?
Yeah, challenging year, challenging couple of years, frankly. So in California, 2016 was the highest year on record since we began reporting the disease in 1995. That year, there were just over 6,000 cases in California. And then last year, 2017, we topped that with more than 8,000 cases. And it looks like 2018 could bulldoze right through those records to set its own. As of the end of May, California has now reported more than twice as many cases as at this time last year. So it remains to be seen what'll happen, through the rest of this year, but it's looking pretty bleak so far. And of course, when you look at the statewide total, more than half of those typically occur here in the San Joaquin Valley, with Kern County taking the brunt of them.
We will continue to follow Valley Fever research, funding, new bills, and the disease itself here at KVPR. And Valley Public Radio is part of the Just One Breath Collaborative, featuring reporting from the Bakersfield Californian and a variety of other organizations focused on this disease, coordinated out of the Center for Health Journalism at USC. You can find all of that on our website at kvpr.org. Carrie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. For several years now, California dairy farmers have been struggling. Low prices, lower demand, tough regulations, drought, and now a trade war all are stacked against local dairy producers. Here to tell us more about all of those developments, especially the issue of trade, is Annie Akmudi with the Western United Dairymen of Modesto. Annie, welcome.
Thank you.
I want to get to the trade issue in a second, as that's certainly been a topic of national concern recently. But more locally, a big issue that has been on the agenda for dairymen across the state for a couple of years now recently came to a head with the federal government adopting a new milk pricing scheme, allowing California dairy operators to participate there. How big of a boost could this be to dairy farmers, which you represent up in Modesto?
There certainly has been a lot of discussion surrounding the potential price gains that producers in California could get from changing the system. And I think producers are optimistic, you know, that we could get something in the range of 40 to 50 cents per hundredweight once it's all said and done and we transfer it to the new system set to come into place actually November 1st of this year.
So for people who aren't professional observers of what's been going on in the dairy industry and how milk is priced, why was the California system not as advantageous to producers as the federal one?
It was a very similar system that had been operated under the umbrella of the California Department of Food and Agriculture. It's been put in place in the 60s, and so California operated in parallel with other similar systems in the rest of the country. But the milk pricing formulas used to price the milk in the state were a bit different than what was happening in the rest of the country. And so they tended to yield a slightly lower price for dairy producers in the state, and that basically placed them at a competitive disadvantage with other producers in the rest of the country who were getting a slightly higher milk price. And so that's where the discussions really started, was based on the fact that our prices in California had been the lowest in the country for many years.
And how has that affected dairy operators here in the state? I've seen the numbers decline over the years. And just earlier this year, we saw the closure of the CDI plant in Los Banos, 63 people laid off there. How has the herd as a whole fared in recent years?
So we're still the number one dairy state, producing, you know, around 18% of the milk in the country. But the production has been certainly shrinking in recent years. You mentioned a lot of issues. The pricing is not necessarily the only one, but we have been losing some ground in California in terms of milk production. We've lost dairies too, so it's not, we had 1,331 dairies left at the end of 2017. If you compare, you know, just 5 years before, it was upward of 1,560 in 2012. And so we've slowly been losing dairies in the state and also milk production in the last few years.
So then that brings us to this issue of trade, which is right now a topic of national concern as retaliatory tariffs are starting to come down now from China. Also, May 31st, Mexico announced its own retaliatory tariffs after the new tariffs imposed on Mexican goods by the Trump administration. How big is the export share of the overall California dairy pie, so to speak? How big of a role do exports play?
Yeah, the milk production in California far outpaces the demand from, you know, local consumers in the state. We have, you know, around 18% of the milk production in the country with about 12% of the population. So a lot of our milk products have to go outside the California borders. And so it's roughly a third stay within California. Another third kind of goes other states, in the U.S., and another third goes to export markets.
So when it comes to North American markets here with Mexico and Canada, how do they compare with the Chinese market? I think we all know that there's a lot of trade that goes on here in the NAFTA area, but China wasn't something I at least had typically thought of as a major export market for dairy. Is that a misconception?
No, I mean, China is the world's largest importer of dairy products, and so they have far more people than they can produce dairy products. And they've had their own issues. If you recall, a few years ago, there's this melamine scandal, and so their consumers are very leery of, Chinese dairy in general. And so they've been really large importer, and they've supported at times strong milk prices globally by significant volumes they've been purchasing. And I think California, through its proximity with the ports, has slowly been growing that market in recent years. And so it depends on what product you look at. Cheese is a recent product that we've been sending to China as they reduced their tariff, you know, last year. Now, obviously, we're going to be facing similar tariff. Now, it depends on what product we're looking at, but we're sending a significant amount. For example, China is our largest market for dry whey products in the U.S. It's now the around eighth largest for cheese. If you look at non-fat dry milk products, skim milk powder is also an important player for the U.S., ranking around eighth largest market. And so China is a very important player, not just for the U.S., but for the global dairy industry. Mexico, on the other hand, is by far a larger market for U.S. exports. It's our largest market. 75% of all the Mexican imports come from the U.S., and so it's a much bigger part of the U.S. dairy industry.
So how long does it take the impact of these tariffs, whether they're announced tariffs yet to be implemented or already implemented retaliatory tariffs that we've seen coming out, how long does that take to filter down to the dairymen in Tulare County or in Stanislaus County?
I think it's already filtered down to some extent to the dairy producers in Tulare. Our pricing formula in California utilize the price of dairy products at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and that market tends to react, you know, to what is going on in the market. And I think the uncertainty has certainly played a big role in bringing the bears in the market, and the prices slowly stopped the ascension it started in recent months. And so we've already seen, I think, a little bit of a decrease occur for the farmers in the Central Valley. Unfortunately, we were on an upward trend. You know, we kind of gained around 60 cents per hundredweight from the first to second quarter of 2018 and kind of lost that ground looking at July prices currently.
Is there any hope out there that with the new pricing scheme set to take effect in California in November that could offset some of this, or is that too far down the road?
It's a bit far down the road. I think it certainly will help, but this is a national issue where not just California is facing this potential glut of product if we lose significant access to our export markets. And if we look at the May data, we had really strong exports in the U.S., record high in some categories. We're exporting around 18% of all the dairy products we produce in the United States. So, you know, losing a share of that can mean more products here stuck within the borders. And when there's more supply than demand, that has a direct impact on milk prices that producers receive.
So what does that translate to on the ground? What sorts of actions would dairy operators be forced to do? Are they thinning their herds or potentially moving out of state? I know those things are already going on aside from this current trade war or trade skirmish. What would the real world impact be?
Producers have been trying to get more and more efficient at what they do. They've been facing negative margins in California. The latest data from the Department of Food and Ag is that it was an average loss of $1.29 per hundredweight of milk produced in the first quarter of 2018. And so I think they were really hoping for some price increase in this latest spat, and trade issues with potential further declines. It's certainly going to be a big concern for certain dairies who have been, trying to work with their lenders to get through these rough times. And so it might incentivize some producers to diversify. We've seen some dairy selling some land to go in the trees, for example, try to diversify their income situation. But for others, it might be consolidation or just exiting the industry entirely.
You mentioned consolidation. That's been another big trend in the dairy industry here in California. Big dairies have been able to weather storms, and some smaller dairies aren't able to withstand some of these economic headwinds, both international and domestic, even here to California. Is that something that you think we'll continue to see?
Yeah, I'm not sure size is entirely going to be the answer. We've seen this slow down in the trend consolidation. I mean, it's still happening, but it's harder in California to grow just because of environmental regulations. And so that won't necessarily be the answer, I think, to surviving the storm. I think some smaller dairies have done really well developing a niche, making either their own product or, you know, some organic dairies. Now that market has softened a bit recently, but there's a lot of ways smaller dairies have tried to weather the storm and still maintain their relevancy and their place in the state of California.
Again, we've been talking about the current economic state of California's dairy industry. The multi-billion dollar ag sector is under new pressure right now as a trade war is brewing between China, Mexico, the United States, Canada, putting California dairy owners in the crosshairs as export markets are an increasing share of what the milk that California dairies produce. We've been talking with Annie Akmudi. She is a director of economic analysis with Western United Dairymen out of Modesto. Annie, thank you so much for taking the time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. Subscribe to our podcast and get all of our stories on demand on our website at kvpr.org. You'll also find the link to download our mobile app for iOS and Android, and you can leave their comments there as well, kvpr.org. For reporter and producer Laura Tsutsui, reporters Carrie Klein, Monica Velez, Christina Lopez, and Mark Benjamin, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.